Mysterious Circumstances is an American Crimecast production. Remember, everyone is innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Hey everybody, this is Justin. Welcome to Mysterious Circumstances Podcast, and we have a pretty awesome episode for you today. It's a very special episode because it is the very first listener co-hosted episode ever. And all the pressure is on my friend Ellie right now, and she's feeling it. She's sweating. But before we introduce her, I just got to acknowledge a couple of reviews real quick. Like to say thank you to Jeff, says solid podcast, and he said he never misses an episode. It's very well researched with cases that haven't been rehashed a million times, and that's pretty much what I like to do. I don't like doing the same shit everybody else does, with the exception of some of the bigger cases. And the next one is another 5-star review from Twaggly or Twaggle. I don't know how the hell to pronounce that, but just says good show and says I didn't like the podcast at first, but it's made vast improvements, and it's what they're looking for in a missing person true crime podcast. So thank you very much. I appreciate everybody leaving reviews. And before we get going, I do got to say, and anybody is welcome to follow me on Instagram. Just type in my name, you can find me. We have the podcast Facebook page and the group now. There's lots of activity going in. Lots of chitter chatter in there going on all the time, so it's pretty fun. A lot of us like talking about the same stuff all the time, so that makes it pretty interesting. I am on Twitter. It's at @M_C_podcast if you want to follow me on there. Just fair warning, on Instagram I do post a lot of inspirational quotes, if you want to call them that, and funny shit for the most part, so pretty random really. But with that being said, I'd like everybody to meet Ellie, who is going to help me out with this episode today. And Ellie, she's all like laughing and shit. Why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself and the case we're going to be talking about today.
Hi, Justin. Just wanted to say, first of all, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's amazing to be the first listener to co-host a show, so it's a real honor. Thank you for that. And today we're going to be discussing the disappearance of Maud Crawford. This was a case that Justin and I, together, kind of felt that it was unfair that he always had to do listener suggestions. So he picked 4 cases and I picked this one of the 4. So yeah, I think it's a pretty interesting case. It's about a pretty remarkable lady, all the things she accomplished for her time. Yeah, I think so that's kind of what drew me to it. And I've never heard of it before, and I think Justin would agree that sometimes it's fun to go over some of the cases that people haven't heard about so much, the ones that aren't maybe quite as famous. So, yeah, we decided to go with this one.
Definitely. And it was the listener's suggestion was from Eric, who is actually from Camden, Arkansas. So thank you, Eric, for this, and I hope you enjoy your episode. And you want to tell us a little bit about Maud's background, Ellie?
Yeah, so Maud Crawford was born on the 22nd of June 1891, which made her 65 on the 2nd of March 1957, which was the date of her disappearance. She was born in Greenville, Texas. Her mother died when she was only 9, so Maud was raised by her grandmother, Mary Louise Fawcett Ritchie, in Warren, Arkansas. Maud was, I think, pretty much by all accounts, a pretty amazing woman for what she achieved, particularly at that time. You know, the women's rights really weren't as big of a thing as they are now. She was a valedictorian of her 1911 graduating class, and she went on to attend the University of Arkansas for the 1911 to 1912 academic year. She didn't actually finish her degree there, but she instead went on in 1916 to work as a stenographer at a law firm in Camden. Now, I didn't actually know what a stenographer was, so I had to look that up. But for anybody that doesn't know, it's if you can write in shorthand, which is kind of using symbols or abbreviations or for words or phrases so that you can write very quickly. And it was often used in sort of journalistic fields or for police officers, secretaries, that kind of thing. So that's what Maud did initially at Gorgon Law Firm. In 1927, after learning a lot of information about the law, Maud took her bar exam at the University of Arkansas School of Law. Not only passed the bar, but she ranked first in her class. She learned, she specialized in management and title work, so estate management and title work being people's wills, shit like that. Maud's admission to the bar was particularly notable because it occurred only 10 years after women were first permitted to practice law in the state of Arkansas. In 1925, Maud married Clyde Falwell Crawford. He was from a prominent family in Arkansas, but the couple had no children. Maud was very prominent in her community. She was the first woman ever to be elected to the Camden City Council. She founded the Arkansas Girl State, which was a counterpart to the more well-known Boy State, which permitted high schoolers to learn about state government at the state capital in Little Rock. She was also president of the Business and Professional Women's Foundation, the American Legion Auxiliary, and the Pilot Club International, which was equivalent to the Rotary before the Rotary Club admitted women. She won awards for her contribution to the community, including the Camden Woman of the Year, and she was also selected to go to Little Rock to collect Camden's Achieve Award for Outstanding Community Improvement. So really, she was just, for her time, what she achieved as a woman was really outstanding. And I can't think of any other woman of that time period that really quite achieved so much.
I honestly don't think there was. She was pretty fucking amazing, to be honest with you. She literally was the elected president of every single woman's civic organization that she was ever a part of. That is pretty fucking stellar for her time.
Well, it is. It sort of it puts me to shame as a 21st century woman. I haven't done one tenth of the shit she has, and I live in a much easier world as a woman. So yeah, you really do have to take your hat off to her for that. One kind of notable thing with Maud's work at the law firm, the Gorgon Law Firm, was that in 1939, a former congressman named John L. McClellan became a partner in the firm, and he was elected to the U.S. Senate in 1942. Now, we'll go into this a little bit more later, but at the time of Maud's disappearance, McClellan chaired a high-profile Senate investigation into alleged mobster ties to organized labor.
Yes, he did. And I think part of that reason, I mean, we like Ellie said, we'll get into a little bit more of this later, but the reason Maud got into estate management title work is because in Arkansas at that point in time, there was petroleum drilling going on all over the place. And at a certain period in the 30s, I can't remember exactly what it was, but there was they had literally so many barrels of petroleum that they could not ship them out fast enough. So when it came down to like estate management and title work, there was a lot of people with a shitload of money. And as a lawyer, an estate lawyer, or dealing with title work, you get percentages of that. So being the smart woman that she was, she definitely chose the right field to be making some money. And judging by her house, she did pretty damn good.
I saw the pictures of her house. It's beautiful.
Oh, it is freaking awesome. It really is. It's just like straight up 50s style. Like, it's an extremely beautiful house. That is for sure.
So that was kind of all of the background stuff I had on Maud. Did you want to talk at all about the timeline of the night that she disappeared, Justin?
Yeah, I suppose. Pretty much what I got is that Sometime earlier in the evening, her husband left to go to the theater and then later the liquor store, which was a nightly routine for Clyde. And this was March 2nd, 1957. Now, from what we know, she disappeared between the hours of 8:30 and 11 p.m. And the reason we know, Clyde was actually gone before 8:30, but the reason we know it's 8:30 is because she had actually made a phone call to her cousin at roughly about 8:30, and Clyde got home at 11 p.m. Now, from what I could find, and we will definitely go over if Ellie found anything else too, is at 11 p.m., Clyde comes home. All the lights in the house and outside the house are on. The TV is on in the sitting room. Maud's purse with $142 in it was sitting on a chair in that room. Let's say after that, we had her car in the driveway with the keys in the ignition. So Clyde waits roughly about an hour to an hour and a half and goes to search for her. Now, from what I could find, and Ellie might have found some other stuff, but at about 1 a.m., Clyde was driving around and actually talked to two police officers out patrolling the streets and asked if there were any car accidents in the area because of the fact that Maud had not returned home yet and figured that she might have left with a friend and been in a car accident or whatnot. And the cops told him there really hadn't been anything going on. So by about 2 a.m., Clyde went to the police station and officially reported her missing. From there, there was a pretty good search for her. I mean, like Ellie was saying, this woman was pretty much, just absolutely a pillar of the community. She was crazy awesome, pretty much, is the only way you can put it. But in all actuality, within about 2 weeks, the news would actually report that the case was cold and there was no reason to continue the investigation. And, Ellie, do you have any insight to that? Do you find anything else?
I got just to kind of elaborate on the last point you had, the police chief at the time, G.B. Cole, I think it was 2 weeks after the disappearance, told the Camden News that the investigation was stalemated, so not very promising.
No.
And in 1969, the probate court of Wichita County declared Maud dead and that she had been dead since the 2nd of March 1957 as a result of foul play.
Yep.
And I think the investigation kind of stayed there for a long time until 1986, when a writer called Beth Brickle wrote an 18-article investigative series for the Arkansas Gazette, and I think we'll discuss that a bit more later. Mm. But that really kind of reignited the case and public interest in the case.
Oh, it did. It definitely did. I don't know. Pretty much, I think the only reason she really wanted to reopen the case, and I could be wrong, was because she actually grew up in that area. And I think I would have to say, like every other woman around that area, Maud Crawford was looked at as, you know, an inspirational figure, I guess you could say, like a motivation. A lot of people had always wondered, yeah, exactly, just like pretty much the perfect role model. I mean, like I said, there's in that day and age, like there's not that many women that accomplish that much, especially in the South. Okay.
Yeah, I actually did pick up on one other thing. The couple apparently had a dog, and when Clyde returned home at approximately 11:30 p.m., the dog was apparently lying there undisturbed. So, I mean, I wasn't able to find out much about the temperament of the dog, whether it was a guard dog, but it's quite unusual to me, almost, that a dog would be lying there so peacefully in such a strange situation. And I know that there's a famous case, the Springfield 3 case, where after the residents of that house disappeared, the dog was really apparently going crazy, and this dog apparently was completely peaceful. Nothing in the house was amiss at all. None of her clothes were gone. So it really was quite a strange scene that Clyde would have walked in on.
Yeah, and that raises a couple, before we get into some theories and about that 1986 investigation, that, like we were talking a little bit before, like, you know, how nobody really even suspected the husband, but the dog being that calm, because I hadn't heard that. I really hadn't heard that, and that just brings to light, like, that it was somebody that knew the dog or somebody that had been around the dog, because the Springfield 3 case, I am familiar with that, and that, yeah, depending on what kind of dog it was, and definitely its, you know, demeanor around the house.
Yeah.
I mean, if it was like a little, you know, like a fucking Shar Pei or something, you know, it probably doesn't care, you know?
Exactly. It's hard to speculate on these things without having a bit more background information, but I do think it's an interesting point of note.
That is a very interesting point of note, actually. Yeah, one of the... Yeah, like we were saying earlier, one of the things that got me too was just how he approached cops, you know, and asked about any car wrecks in the area, because her car was in the driveway with the keys in the ignition. But if that was, you know, the case, and she would have left for a friend with a friend, you wouldn't think that she would leave every light in the house and outside the house, the TV on, with her purse with cash in it,
exactly,
sitting on a chair. It just doesn't make any sense. And the fact that he waited so long. Like, if I would have came home and, like, saw that shit and, like, nobody was around, I would probably... And, I mean, yeah, there's no cell phones, but I wouldn't have waited, like, an hour to an hour and a half to go out looking, you know?
Exactly. I think you had a really good point there, as we were just talking a little bit before the show. I mean... What I kind of originally thought was, well, you know, she was obviously very active in her community. She probably had a lot of friends. She probably had a lot going on. So perhaps Clyde came in and thought, oh, she, you know, a friend's come and picked her up and she's out for the evening. But you are absolutely right. Well, if that were the case, would she leave all the lights on? Would she leave the TV blaring? Would she leave her purse at home? And just for the record, $142 back then now is worth just over $1,200.
Yes,
so, you know, that wasn't a tiny amount to be leaving lying around.
Hell no. I wish I had $1,200 laying around. Shit. Yeah.
Well, I mean, to be fair, she probably was pretty rich, but still.
I could definitely imagine, like Ellie had said earlier, her husband's family was actually one of the pioneers of that town. So he was a very, very well-to-do guy, and they were a very well-to-do family, especially. And she didn't just marry into it. She earned that shit. She was a very smart woman.
Add to that, they were childless, too. So
yeah, they had no
really
kids.
Really had no one to spend their money on but themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, in that badass house they had. But
there was one other point which I thought was quite interesting that I read. So after Maud had disappeared, Clyde wound up selling the car, and it eventually ended up in the hands of a person called Don Harrell in April of 1957. And he actually found...
You said April 1957, right?
Yes.
Okay.
April 1957. So this is, you know, just kind of a month or so after Maud's disappearance.
Okay.
He found a grocery store receipt underneath the front seat of the car dated 2nd of March 1957, which was, of course, the day of Maud's disappearance.
Yeah.
Now, on the back of this receipt was a phone number, a Camden phone number. So on the back of the receipt was a Camden telephone number. Don Harrell passed the receipt on to Detective Cole, the lead investigator, but rather frustratingly, he never heard anything more about it. So that was really a dead end right there.
Huh. I wish they would have had it. And they didn't say anything about a time on that receipt, huh?
They gave a date, but they did not give a time, no.
Hmm. That's pretty damn interesting, especially since it didn't make it that far.
Yeah. So I don't know. It could be nothing, but I thought it was certainly worth mentioning.
Yeah, it is definitely worth mentioning. That's for sure. That's a pretty interesting fact right there, if I do say so myself.
Cool. So, did you want to jump into theories or?
Well, let's go ahead and shake down this 1986 investigation here.
Okay. Okay.
Let's see. From what I gathered, in 1986, the case was reopened by, like Ellie had said, a lady named Beth Brickle, and she was an investigative journalist. And in this, it was a series of articles in the newspaper that ran for 5 months long. And she actually implicated a guy named Henry Berg. He was also known as Mike. He was a very wealthy businessman in the area, and he was also a former state police commissioner. During the investigation, it was revealed that a guy named Otis Henley, who was a state police detective, had actually found evidence linking Berg to the murder of Maud Crawford. Now, what Henley had claimed is, before what he actually claimed, because I'll be honest with you, I tried writing this shit down and remembering it, but it was, like, so, like, detailed, I couldn't do it. But after the information I'm about to feed you, he was actually removed from the case, and all his files on this case had actually vanished. And what he had found was that this is basically the first time any kind of financial motive for the murder of Maud Crawford would have been uncovered. And he found that a deed that was filed in a nearby county in Hope, Arkansas, that had actually transferred timber assets belonging to Rose Newman Berg, which was Mike's elderly aunt. She had actually been declared incompetent in 1955 by the county court. And
if I could just jump in here,
please
I
do,
actually
please
read
do.
It. That would be called Alzheimer's disease today.
Yes, it would be. Yeah, she was pretty bad off, and Maud Crawford was her estate attorney, apparently. And old Rose Berg, she was a millionaire. She was set to leave more than $20 million in 1950s money to three of her nieces. And what happened was, old Mike Berg started transferring all these deeds and all these titles and a lot of, what was it called? I don't want to say royalties, but it was basically, it pretty much was to a lot of
oil royalties. Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
Yeah, it was freaking oil rig royalties. And there was actually a couple signatures that were questioned by Maud Crawford, and she had apparently confronted him about it. Now, obviously, we don't actually know what happened, because unfortunately, by that point in time, pretty much anybody involved with that case had passed away, which is extremely unfortunate, to be honest with you. But that, I don't know, when I start looking at cases, I start looking at, motive and opportunity, and I'm not, like, too far gone to be inclined to think that at some point in time, Clyde Crawford, being who he was, probably knew Mike Berg, you know, both of them being pretty high up in the community. I don't know. I suppose with that, we should probably roll into the theories a little bit here.
Wow, that was actually a very interesting connection you made there. I never really kind of thought, because I never read that Clyde would have known Mike Berg or his family, but that's an interesting point you raise. As we said earlier, Clyde was from a very well-known, prominent family in the area, so it is quite possible that he would have been connected to the Berg family.
Yeah, or at least known Clyde's habits and when he was not going to be at the house, you know.
Exactly.
But anyway, so what's there's only really, in all honesty, people, there's only probably two or three theories on this. And I would have to venture to say even three. There's actually only about two of them. But I would have to say three, and we'll go with the probably the, I don't want to say the shittiest one first, but Clyde Crawford is one small theory that people have considered, because in all actuality, like, his actions after coming home, the time frame, he had a solid alibi every single night. So it wouldn't be too far-fetched to say, oh, well, you know, he was gone. Just coming home with all the lights on, TV on, you know, the dog obviously not raising any kind of hell whatsoever. Waiting that long for his wife to come home before he came out looking for her, you know, suggesting to the cops, looking for a car accident, after he knew, obviously, she wasn't driving. But at the same time, she left all her personal belongings, including money, at home. Now, that is one theory. Personally, I don't think it holds much ground, just because I don't really see a motive for it.
I was completely agreeing with you there. There's certainly means for him to have done it, or at least had somebody get rid of her, but... Yeah. Yeah, I can't see a motive there. I don't think there would have been a financial incentive, because I think they were both pretty well off.
Yeah,
and I didn't read anything about any insurance policies.
Yep.
And from what I read, they had a very happy marriage. Mm-hmm. In fact, in general, Maud seemed to get along with most people. She didn't have any skeletons in her closet, so to speak. So,
no.
Again, yeah, I just don't see a motive for it.
I don't either. I really don't. I mean, it's... You know, don't get me wrong, some of his actions are weird, but I just don't see any motive for it. And I don't know, you wanna maybe take us down the mob theory road, Ellie?
Sure. So I think earlier I mentioned a congressman, John L. McClellan, who became a partner at the law firm that Maud worked for, and he was, I guess, probably quite high up on a list of mobsters, people that they wanted to get rid of or at least scare, because he was leading quite a high profile Senate investigation into mob activity within organized labor. Now, I guess the kind of an obvious question that springs to my mind is, why would the mob not come after him directly? I think that's a valid question, but the theory goes, he was the person that got rid of Maud because, I guess, as a scare tactic to use against John L. McClellan. I think the police dismissed this theory because there was no ransom. Now, personally, that doesn't really mean much to me, because from what I know of organized crime, I don't know that they typically do ask for a ransom. I mean, one case that really springs to mind is Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah.
He disappeared really without a trace, and there was no body ever found. There was nobody asking for any ransom money, and this seems like it could be a similar situation. So I wouldn't discount the organized crime aspect to this. I think it is a possibility, but my biggest problem with it is that I don't see why they wouldn't go after him directly. Why they would particularly is not clear to me.
I totally agree with that, but the only reason I think they wouldn't go after him directly is because he is way more high profile, and that would bring a lot more attention to them than what they would probably want. So they would probably go for a smaller target, you know, because Maud Crawford was in the spotlight, but this guy was the chairman of a Senate committee hearing, you know, or a Senate committee investigation.
Right, yeah, and he was a senator.
Yeah, if he disappears, that's automatic feds, man. You know, that's the government after your ass, as opposed to, like, the state cops, you know.
That's a really good point that you make, I guess. The only thing I would say to possibly counter that is, I mean, look at the JFK assassination and RFK.
Oh, Fidel, you know, did that.
There are theories that the mobsters were involved in that. So,
in all honesty,
I mean, obviously, I don't know if that's true or not.
I don't know. I'm not being a conspiracy theorist here, but Oh man, I got a lot of theories on that one, and it involves New Orleans Mafia and
That could be a show
Trafficante,
all on its own,
and
right?
that would be like a 2-month-long show right there. That would be that's too much to handle right there. And then yeah, but no, the I don't know, not to go on a tangent here, but Sam Giancana did help old JFK get into office
He did.
by
He
doing
did,
Joe.
yes.
He did old Joe Kennedy some favors over there in Chicago, because they had to win Illinois
The
in order
county
to
won it in
become
Cook
president.
County, I think it was.
Yep, and if there was anybody that could help control the polls, it was Sam Giancana.
Yes.
And supposedly the part of the deal was when he got elected president, the heat would be taken off of the mob. Well, the first
Exactly.
thing JFK did was elect his brother attorney general, and the first thing RFK did was start going after the fucking mob.
Yeah, not the smartest decision.
Probably not. It's like, come on, guy, really? You set me up for failure, man. Fucking little bro, ruining shit. But anyway, the mob theory's not too bad, but I gotta go with the Mike Berg theory, because the means, the motive were there. They were just
I
there.
agree. I think that the Mike Berg theory is the most compelling because it is an extremely strong financial motive that Mike Berg would have had. And also, just one small point. Obviously, Maud was Roseberg's attorney, but she was also her personal guardian because don't forget this woman had Alzheimer's disease. She obviously wasn't in her right mind. So there was probably almost an emotional element of it as well for Maud, where she was that some kind of testament to her good nature and how nice of a person she was, that she actually had told Mike, sorry, Roseberg's nieces that she would be bringing a lawsuit against Mike Berg. So he's not only did he stand to lose this money that he was essentially embezzling from his aunt, but he also stood to be sued and taken to court. So that right there is an extremely strong motive he would have had for getting rid of Maud. And once she disappeared, surprise, surprise, so did Roseberg's will. So I think that sort of speaks volumes.
Yes, it does. And given that it's a small town, it's not hard to believe that at any point in time, some of your neighbors might be doing, and
Exactly,
it's
exactly. I guess one other theory that I feel like we should mention, even though I don't think it's applicable here at all, but I guess it's kind of obligatory whenever you have an adult that goes missing, there's always the possibility that they could have left on their own accord.
That is
So I think we
true.
have to mention that. But in this case, I think for so many reasons, that's really unlikely. I mean, she would have had no motive to leave. She
Yeah.
was happy in her life, she was settled. And even if she was going to leave, would she leave her purse with her money in it? Would she leave the TV on? Would she leave her car with the keys in the driveway? So I really don't think that that is a viable option here, but I feel like we need to mention it because at the end of the day, she was an adult that disappeared, and adults can voluntarily disappear.
Yes, they can, and I agree with that 100%. There always is a possibility, and like I listened to a podcast called The Vanished, and
Oh, I listened to that one too.
oh
That's
my
a
God,
good
it's I just got hooked on it. I
one.
just joined the Facebook group. I'm in there commenting and shit, and there's actually a case of that's from right here, what by where I live, around Fort Wayne, Indiana. And there's a damn good chance I'm probably gonna do an episode on that, because it is freaking phenomenal. But you got it. You can never take out that theory, I guess, that they left on their own accord. Because I mean,
Exactly.
there's no signs of a struggle. There was nothing broken.
Exactly. She
But
would have had means, to get by
exactly.
on her own.
Yeah, she would have. And even though that, there was X amount of dollars in her purse, it's not to say she wasn't shoving some money under her, mattress or something, and
Yeah, I imagine she probably had a lot more than $142 to her name at that time of all of her career accomplishments.
I'm pretty sure, given her career and her husband, yeah, I'm pretty sure
Yeah.
they were doing pretty fine. So, but yeah, I don't know. Personally, I gotta roll with the Mike Berg theory. It just
I
makes the most
agree.
sense. Yeah. All right.
It's is definitely the most compelling.
It is.
I wouldn't discount the mobster theory, but
I
yeah,
wouldn't either.
Like
yeah, I wouldn't either. It is a very good theory, and I mean, at first I was a little 50-50 on it, but I think the Mike Berg just had more solid ground to stand on, I suppose you could say.
Yeah, and actually, you know, just to kind of reiterate what a real piece of work this guy was, he actually paid off each one of Roseberg's nieces who were actually originally supposed to inherit from her will. He paid them off $187,000 each in exchange for them relinquishing their rights to any
yep.
claim on her estate.
Yep.
And that kind of really goes to show what a shady individual he was.
That's pretty shitty, to be honest with you, yeah. I mean, yeah, they're probably like, well, at least we're getting something, but at the end of the day, I'm pretty sure without Maud Crawford around, any kind of court case wouldn't have had any ground to stand on.
I agree.
Unfortunately.
I totally agree.
Well, Ellie, I think that pretty much would wrap up the episode.
Okay.
You're all smiles, so I'm assuming you think you did a good job. I think you did. You did awesome.
I think I'm too nervous to comment on that yet, but I guess we shall see. But I enjoyed it, so, you know, I'm happy with that. I had a great time. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, no problem. And for those of you who don't know, she is in England, and she is, like, 5 hours behind me right now, so she is probably tired as shit. So I appreciate you hanging out and staying up and all that good stuff. I think it was a pretty good episode. Yeah, I think it was a success. You did a hell of a good job.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, I suppose until then, till the next time, thank you, Ellie, again. I appreciate it, and I imagine I'll talk to you tomorrow. And, you know, I'll go ahead and let you know if I lose my job to you or not. Because here in about an hour, this is going to be posted, so... We'll
oh
see. We'll
God.
See what they
That's
say.
Scary.
I'll send you some screenshots. All right. Well, I suppose until next time then. Like I said, Ellie, thank you again, and you have a good night. And
you too.
I'll try here and finish some beers. But until then, all you listeners out there, I'll see you guys on the flip side.